Introducing whiny ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
It is Tuesday, December 14th, 2010. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar District, Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Wow. The combination of me having absolutely no sleep and Evan's dropping that... Now, you worked at a radio station. Is that correct, Evan?
What was wrong with what just happened?
That thing dropped off a cliff. Those drums go, and all of a sudden, just like, boom, done.
You were talking over the drums.
We got to figure out a we got to get this ASCAP license, get some music, some real musical beds in here, and we will do that at the beginning of the year, folks. Come January, when we come back from our tiny, tiny, tiny holiday, things will be great. And then also, I think we will also be able to have an opportunity to talk to whiny-ass TT baby conservatives, as that John Benjamin Liner suggests. Hopefully we will be taking phone calls by that point. Yesterday on the program, folks... Oh, I should also say... yesterday on the program, we broke some news. Did I mention that? Because I think I knew at the time we had broken some news.
Yeah, you mentioned it.
And that story with Glenn Greenwald has played out a little bit more in the WikiLeaks story. I've got a huge stack of stuff here to deal with today. And... let's just jump right in on the healthcare. I guess this happened as we were coming out of our show. There was a ruling in Virginia where a federal judge ruled on a case brought by the Attorney General of Virginia, Cuccinelli. Was that it?
I think it's Cuccinelli.
Did you see this? I was on Dylan Radigan yesterday. Did you see this, Dorsey?
I did not catch it, no.
I was on Dylan Radigan yesterday talking about this and with Anna Marie Cox and Tim Carney, a libertarian, God bless his soul. And Radigan's like, so you down with a cooch? I just thought... Am I confused? But that's a sort of a like a vernacular term for a woman's organ. Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, I don't mean to make it sound very clinical, but I don't know why we have an explicit rating on iTunes. We got the explicit rating up. We couldn't get the picture up, the graphic, the logo of the Majority Report. But I just started losing it. And, you know, I'm looking at Radigan like, did you mean to say, like, are we really? All right. I got no problem with that.
What did Anna Marie Cox do? She just
I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine she has a problem with it, too.
No,
like,
no,
her
no,
whole...
No, she, yeah, I think she would get a kick out of it first out of anybody.
Right. Know? Her career was all about, like, the cooch, right? It was all... I mean, if there was no... Anna Marie Cox was formerly Wonkette. She was the first Wonkette. Is that not correct? Did she start it, or was she hired to be Wonkette? I think she was hired, right?
I think that she started it as a blog, and then it got scooped up and turned into a huge blog. Like,
and then she decided not to do it. But the thing that really broke Wonkette more than anything, of course, first of all, if you talk gossip about a community that has the ability to generate news. That's a one way ticket to being, to getting to success. But then on top of that, the big story was the Washingtonian, who was she worked in a congressional office, and she was also a prostitute or something to that effect, right? And you know, that's like catnip. for people who are not me. I just remember being like, seriously, what? Although I think I did when, you know, like when she finally came out to, like, she sort of revealed herself. I think I did sort of check out, like, you know, what the deal was. All right, be that as it may, I lost track of where I was.
I'm
the
sorry,
healthcare.
I apologize. It was...
Why? What? No, that's what I was talking about. The Cucciamina thing was like, I couldn't. Cuccinelli, right? And so, this, understand that this specifically, the judge ruled on Section 1501, which is the section of the healthcare reform which mandates that everyone essentially buy health insurance. As it's written, it's basically you have to pay a tax that you can that I guess you could deduct. You could make a deduction if you pay for this health care that would not impose a tax upon you. I mean, it's designed that way, basically, so that it's a considered a legitimate tax as opposed to a penalty, because taxes have to raise revenues as opposed to be penalties. But it's pretty easy to write a tax, so it doesn't function in that manner. Well, the long and short of this federal judge's ruling, Henry Hudson, was that the Commerce Clause does not apply here. The Congress has no right to mandate this because it doesn't have to do with interstate commerce. And there was another ruling about, attempting to force this under the Necessary and Proper Clause by the Congress, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line is that almost universally, you know, whether you're talking about go to the Volokh conspiracy, who's this Eugene Volokh, who's a UCLA law school professor, who's a libertarian types right leaning. He says this ruling is bad. Essentially, constitutional law lawyers and professors and experts from across the political spectrum think this is sort of a ridiculous ruling. There have been 14 other federal cases that have been either been ruled the other direction or dismissed because there was barely no case there. Now, with that said, if you had polled if you had polled law professors and constitutional legal experts prior to the Supreme Court's ruling in Bush v. Gore, and ask them, was the Supreme Court ever going to take this case? Or do you think the Supreme Court could ever possibly find a ruling where they would stop the counting in Florida because it would prejudice the idea that George Bush had already won in any fashion? Do you think that's actually possible? Honestly, you would have been laughed at. I mean, I can assure you, I followed this in real time back in 2000, with the obsessive compulsiveness of an obsessive compulsive, and I mean, I have literally 500 photographs of my television as proof, and I refused at that time to, for artistic integrity's sake, to videotape any of it, so that all of my photographs were live. And there was no digital cameras back then. It was all photographs I took of my television.
How many? 500?
500, at least. Wow. In fact, at the beginning of A Bad Situationist, a DVD that many of our members have requested in lieu of their cheap-ass mug, instead getting a high-quality DVD film with hours of extras, including an appearance of Stephen Colbert before he was Stephen Colbert. Oh, yeah. The opening is actually a series of these photographs that I incorporated into the and I was going to make a coffee table book with these photographs. They're actually quite interesting and depressing. And but I never did, of course. It was just I don't know what I did. I just sort of rolled them on the floor and then rolled around in them and, you know, felt bad about myself. I don't know. But so I can tell you that no one have anticipated the Supreme Court to do that. And this iteration of the Supreme Court is equally, if not more partisan, but certainly far more psycho right wing. And but. So understand that the case now has to go to the appellate level and then it goes to the Supreme Court. There is an issue, I should also say before I say the next point, that for some reason, at the end of the process of making this legislation, the idea of severability was stripped from this bill. Severability is a, I don't know how pro forma it is, I don't know how boilerplate it is, but it's a clause that essentially says, if for some reason any part of one section of this bill is found to be unconstitutional or is repealed, the rest of the bill is severed from it and still exists. That clause does not exist in this bill. I've been reading quite a bit on this. Some people say, well, the judge's ruling was very narrow to this. So the legislation would remain, health care reform would remain, even if this part of the bill was stripped out. I've seen other people who have said that, well, Cuccinella, Punchinella, whatever his name is, could go back to the court and say, hey, you know, yes, you ruled this way, but this bill is not severable. The whole thing should go down the tubes. So, you know, nobody really knows the outcome of this, but I will say this. Here's a way that I think is becoming very easy to determine the outcome of just about anything that happens in this day and age. If you were to take the mandate out, if you were to take the mandate out of the healthcare reform bill, and the mandate is in there because the healthcare reform bill requires that insurance companies, among other requirements, that it not reject people for pre-existing conditions starting in 2014. There's no rejecting people for pre-existing conditions. And so what it means is that the risk pool, follow me here, would be a true risk pool in terms of American society. In other words, it would not, 80% of healthcare costs are borne by 20% of the people. And so, for instance, when you look at Medicare costs, there's a reason why Medicare is, dollar for dollar for per capita is more expensive than any other health insurance programs, is because it caters to old people and to poor people. And old people and poor people tend to have more medical problems. So the risk pool is higher, essentially. It's the risk is spread. There's a higher amount of risk spreading around a smaller group of people. If everyone in the country enters into an insurance program, this is why single payer makes so much sense, then the risk is spread out amongst the greatest number of people in America. So healthy young fellows like Evan and Dorsey, although one could argue as to their health based on their lifestyle choices, they are low risk. But if they're paying into a system, they are spreading the risk in the cost of like old people like myself and infirm people like myself across that board. No, I'm very healthy. I'm just making a point, folks. And so the point is, if there is no mandate and you still have these requirements on health insurance companies, it will destroy the private health insurance industry. It will destroy it. Now, I have no problem with that. I think it's a, with all due respect to those of you who work in that industry, I don't think that the industry is necessarily evil, although that there's a lot of evidence that would suggest it is. Things like rescission, things like refusal to pay for certain costs, things like keeping sick people out, trying to keep their risk pool, you know, to basically have as many people as they know actuarially will be healthy as possible and reject those who may be sick, et cetera, et cetera. I have no problem whatsoever with the demise of the private health insurance industry. I suspect the right-wing hacks on the Supreme Court, even if it means foregoing their precious pre-legal principles, which seem to ebb and flow depending on what it is that they want to decide, would have a problem with that, as would their handmaidens in Congress and in the Senate. So, very hard for me to believe that that provision will be repealed without it taking down all of healthcare. But I must suggest, and you know, this is one of the stupid things about healthcare being initiated in 2014, but that was a way of making the costs seem like they were less. It would be very hard to tell people, hey, you know how your kids, your 26-year-olds are now covered under healthcare? No more. Hey, you know how the children with pre-existing conditions could get health? No more. You know how you have healthcare pre-existing conditions and you were anticipating being able to buy healthcare in a year, let's say, by the time it gets to the Supreme Court? No more. That could be very difficult. That could be very scary for private health insurance, too. So I welcome this. I would love to see what happens as it goes through the appellate process, because much harder to take things away from people. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with this. So, interesting, and could get more interesting as it goes on, because, you know, we're at the point where I think, like, you know, the idea of some type of revolutionary process. UPS is here. Thank you very much. Do you hear anything about this healthcare thing? Did you hear anything about this healthcare bill being repealed?
I heard a little.
Yeah?
I don't know too much about it. What are they saying?
Well, I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal in terms of... Are you in favor of the healthcare reform?
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Fair enough.
What's your name?
Sam. That was the UPS guy. He is in favor of the health care reform. Why not? All right. Fair enough. Why not indeed? Following up on a story from yesterday, we broke some news on this program with the interview with Glenn Greenwald. And I had brought up Crew's Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington's response to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And they had criticized Julian Assange, said that it was really bad for the transparency fight to have that much transparency. If you're going to do transparency, you got to do it through the you got to get permission from the government to do transparency. I mean, more or less. I may be doing a little bit less justice to Crew's response. And I read this to Glenn Greenwald without knowing that he actually sat on the board of directors of Crew. And he said it was an offensive statement, a stupid statement, an illogical statement. And he said, actually, I sit on the board of directors of Crew, and I am seriously considering resigning publicly because of it. And sure enough, folks, literally an hour, I think it was, after our program wrapped, Glenn Greenwald posted a letter that he sent, or I don't know if he posted the letter, he sent the letter publicly, it was covered on the Politico, to the board of directors of Crew, I am hereby resigning from the board of directors effective immediately. I fully expected when joining the board that Crew would periodically take positions with which I disagreed, and that was perfectly acceptable to me. But the recent condemnation of WikiLeaks by Anne Weissman purporting to speak on behalf of Crew is both baffling and unacceptable to me. It's baffling because I cannot fathom how a group purportedly devoted to greater transparency in government could condemn an entity that has brought more transparency to government and corporations around the world, than any single other organization by far. And it is unacceptable to me because I believe defense of WikiLeaks has become the greatest and most important political causes that exist. Certainly one to which I intend to devote myself. And I do not want to be affiliated with any group that which works to undermine it. I remain supportive of much of the work done by Crew and wish the organization nothing but the best. Very truly yours, Glenn Greenwald. How would you characterize that letter?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like he wishes them well, but he just doesn't want to be a part of them. You know?
Right.
It's not
sincere, yeah.
Yes, I thought that was a very reasonable letter. Didn't speak to the character of the organization except for, basically, I remain much of the supportive of the work.
Yeah.
Now, I should say, and I don't want to say this without going into details, and I don't know all the details, but there has been some controversy about Crew, and particularly its executive director, who is leaving shortly to join Lanny Davis's lobbying firm. Now, Lanny Davis is perhaps one of the greatest hacks that are out there. This man will prostitute himself for just about any cause, and use his I guess he was counsel to Bill Clinton's bona fides, you know, to prostitute himself. That is his, you know, his political equivalent of sexual organs. It was that he was a Democratic strategist. And he will prostitute that to the highest bidder. So he's been stumping for things like Verizon, I think. I can't remember exactly. And, you know, it was the type of thing where, like, Mark Green would come to me at Air America and say, hey, do you want to write something on Huffington Post about how bad this thing that Obama said was, you know, in defense of Clinton or some like, just, and I would say, no, of course not. You know, if only because the request came from you. And then literally, like, you know, 2 hours later or 3 hours later, Lanny Davis would post the exact same thing that, you know, Green wanted to, because he was just, you know, whatever. And apparently, over the summer, Lanny Davis was lobbying on behalf of for-profit universities that have been in for-profit student loan organizations that have been less than scrupulous. And Melanie Sloan and Crew, for some reason, came out in defense of these entities. And nobody could understand why. And then, of course, Melanie Sloan ends up going to work or announcing that she's going to work for Lanny Davis. All right, so I mentioned that. And I don't know. Do your own research on it. I'm not smearing her in any way. I'm explaining to you. I'm giving you a very clear, unbiased perspective on that controversy. I am smearing Lanny Davis. I have no problem with that. And so Crew responded in this manner. Crew Executive Director Melanie Sloan responds that Greenwald's resignation, this is as reported by Politico, is quite welcome. Glenn is using Crew merely as a foil for his own press ambitions rather than to make any real policy points. Let me tell you something. Anyone who is familiar with Glenn Greenwald, the idea that Glenn Greenwald uses anything for his own press ambitions, never mind Crew, is essentially like saying, like, I am using this show as my to further my own ambition to be, you know, featured in a weightlifting magazine. You know, it's like, it really is that ludicrous. If there is one person out there who has the most contrary media ambitions of probably any individual that I've ever referenced, or that anyone could ever read, it's Glenn Greenwald. It's almost like media ambition is almost antithetical to what he does.
Yesterday when I was searching for the story, I was searching, you know, for anything, any background, whatever, and I put his name in with Crew, even the full spelling of Crew, you know, and nothing really came up.
Oh, right, yes. He's never leveraged this at all, ever. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And frankly, who knows who Crew is?
That's the other thing.
I got news for you. More people know who Glenn Greenwald is than know what Crew is. So this is just a ludicrous charge. I mean, it's an obscenely ridiculous charge. And go back and listen. We've clipped the audio from Glenn when he's talking about Crew. He very explicitly talks. This is completely about policy. Completely about policy. She said, adding that she learned of the resignation from the press. This is the second time recently that Glenn has chosen to take his disputes with Crew public without discussing them with us. Well, that goes to what Dorsey just said. I don't know how public his disputes with Crew could have been, that Dorsey can't even find it on Google.
I wasn't even looking for the disputes. I was just looking for their names together.
To be associated together, right. She accused Greenwald and other progressives of demonizing us for disagreeing on WikiLeaks. Now, excuse me? So now she's slagging other progressives. I mean, there's some clear positioning here. You want to... I'll tell you what you should Google. Google Lenny Davis accuse progressives. See how many hits that brings up. Honestly. Probably a thousand, like thousands of hits. There are people, professional Democrats, professional quasi-liberals, who make a living on hippie punching. And apparently, Melanie Sloan has joined. What? Why are you laughing?
The third thing that comes up is Melanie Sloan calls Glenn Greenwald big poopy head. And I looked for Lanny Davis accused progressives. That's the third thing that comes
up. Yeah. I mean, so, and she writes, quote, I guess the current position du jour. I don't even know what that framing means. But it's also another way of saying, like, dilettante, naive, non-villagers. Because I think that you can't find anyone more consistent with their positions than Glenn Greenwald, period, ever, regardless of administration, regardless of what party he's talking about, nowhere. The current position du jour is you're supposed to be on WikiLeaks' side no matter what. And if you're varying from that, you're terrible, you're awful, you're evil. Well, no, I think Glenn had a problem with Crew's statement. You know, this is, it's depressing. It's depressing insofar as, you know, just to see more people whore themselves out in some respect. It's depressing. It's depressing when Peter Orszag goes to Citibank. You know, like the 500,000-600,000 he could have made as a top line, you know, professor at a business school, writing a book, a lecture tour, you know, whatever. The $1 million a year he could have made, that not enough. Not enough. I'm gonna take the huge money at Citibank for vague duties. I mean, I understand people going for money. I understand that. I like money. I'd like to have more money. Incidentally, you can become a member of the Majority Report at majoritycreport.fm. I would like that. But I mean, God. Surely Peter Orszag is aware of what it looks like to the public. Forget if there's anything nefarious or not involved in it. Surely Peter Orszag is aware of what it looks like to the public. For him to jump from the Obama administration into the waiting arms of people who have received billions, if not trillions, of tax dollars or subsidies or bailouts or whatever you want to call it. Surely he must be aware of that. But at age 41, no, I need to cash in my chips now. Fuck it. Melanie Sloan, same thing. Now, maybe Peter Orszag has a desperately ill child that I don't know about, and who, you know, whose medical bills are in the millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and maybe Melanie Sloan does too. And I'm sure there are mitigating circumstances. I'm not in a position to judge in those circumstances. Maybe I'm not in a position to judge in any circumstances. I just find it repulsive. I find it depressing and repulsive. And that's not a judgment. That's an expression of my own emotional feelings. And if you can't handle that, Dorsey, then you're not meeting my needs. And let's go to couples therapy. That's not a judgment on my part. It just, you know, saying that it nauseates me and it's pathetic. It feels like it's pathetic to me. Not a judgment. All right. So let's play. With that said, that controversy. You should also know WikiLeaks, Justin Assange. Julian Assange, out on bail today. Michael Moore posted his bail.
Get out.
Or at least $20,000, or at least he suggested he was or was involved in it. It's unclear.
The time that we went on air, it was unclear who.
It's unclear whether who posted, but he certainly offered up $20,000.
Yeah.
And you know, again, I feel it's like inappropriate almost on some level to comment on Julian Assange's, you know, charges in Sweden. I don't know if this is consistent with this poll. I don't know if it's consistent that he would be held without bond for so long or bail. What I do find problematic is that there are some rumors that there's secret indictments of him in the United States, which I think is preposterous. There's absolutely no evidence that he has broken any American law whatsoever. And to the extent that anybody can make that argument, they better bring in the New York Times. They better bring in the Guardian newspaper. They better bring in the Washington Post. I guess, theoretically, they should bring me in, too, right? I read it. I read one of those cables. I hope Michael Moore's got plenty of bail bond money for all of us. With that said, let's go to part two of my interview with Glenn Greenwald. Excuse me. This is part two of my interview with Glenn Greenwald, wherein we discuss other civil liberty issues that are relevant today, particularly the Obama administration's assassination program and the recent move by Democrats to keep perpetrators or alleged perpetrators of 9/11 and other terrorist attacks from getting trials in federal criminal courts. Let's go to that interview now. It was reported last week that Democrats still controlling the House in the House have approved legislation to prevent Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other detainees at Guantanamo Bay from being transferred to the U.S. for trials in criminal courts. Now, this, of course, is following the conviction of Ahmed Gilani, who was only found guilty on one of many, many counts, but the guy's going to go to prison for perhaps for life. And the conviction rate in criminal courts is far greater than in these military commissions. Give me your sense of what this is about. I mean, this is the one thing they can get done in the lame duck session?
Well, you know, I think there's a real question of what the Obama administration's actual position on this legislation is. Of course, publicly they said that they oppose it, but frequently they take a public position and then work behind the scenes privately for the opposite outcome. What we know is that Eric Holder, a year ago, to his great credit, announced that the five 9/11 defendants, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, were going to be tried in a real court, in a federal court, with all the civil protections that courts and the Constitution afford to people that we want to imprison. And because of the political firestorm that erupted, essentially the White House overruled him, which is an extraordinary thing for the political arm of the White House to overrule decisions about prosecutions made by the Attorney General.
That's something that was a huge scandal in the Bush administration, frankly.
Right. That was something that Democrats used to really get angry about when that was the argument, the crux of the Roberto Gonzalez scandal, was that the White House was firing prosecutors and as a means of controlling prosecutions and which ones were made and which ones weren't in a way that advanced their interests. And lots, I mean, Richard Nixon tried controlling the Watergate investigation by firing the Attorney General and the Special Prosecutor that led to the Saturday Night Massacre. So this effort to control Justice Department decisions on the part of the White House is something that really is quite alarming. They did the same thing by trying to direct Eric Holder not to prosecute Bush officials for torture and eavesdropping crimes as well for political reasons. So you've seen this repeatedly. And so clearly the White House said that they were going to make an announcement that Obama was going to decide himself where these five defendants should be tried. And they've never, it's been almost a year now while these defendants continue to rot away at Guantanamo, and they've never made any kind of decision at all about where these trials are going to take place. Clearly they don't want to put them in civilian trials, but they also don't want to override Holder. They don't want to make a decision at all. Legislation that would say we're defunding your ability to bring these detainees to the United States in order to try them would essentially solve the problem for them. They could say, well, it's not our fault that we're not trying them. The Congress has prevented us. And Adam Serwer in the Washington Post actually has a piece assessing what he thinks is the likelihood that the Obama administration behind the scenes is signaling to the Democrats in Congress that they're absolutely fine with this legislation as a means of taking the problem away from them.
Right. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine that the Democrats in Congress have this on their list of things to do in the lame duck session. It would create much more problems for the Republicans, frankly, for them to have to do it down the road. Of course, the Republicans wouldn't do it. They would use it to bash the Obama administration. So this is a pretty cynical move as far as I can tell. But and just quickly, I also want to just get your take on, I guess it was last week or a week or two ago, that a federal judge basically decided that the father of the anti-American cleric, Anwar al-Awlaki, has no standing to ask the U.S. government to not assassinate his son. Tell us a little bit about this, because I don't think people understand what authority the Obama administration is asserting here.
Right. Well, it's 100% confirmed by Dana Priest in the Washington Post first and then the New York Times and the Washington Post a few months later that the Obama administration, that President Obama has compiled a hit list of at least four American citizens whom the CIA is directed and authorized to kill with a drone attack or anything else. This killing would take place far away from any battlefield. So the person it's not on a battlefield where the killing happens when he's fighting American troops. He could be sleeping in his house, he could be riding in a car with his friends or family on his way to work, wherever, as many of these drone attacks have taken place. And the individuals on this list, such as Awlaki, have never been charged with any crime whatsoever. They've never been indicted, let alone convicted. So the accusation that they're terrorists or that they deserve to die is one that is purely a unilateral byproduct of the decision of the president without any oversight or checks whatsoever from any of the other branches. So it's essentially the president literally acting as judge, jury, and executioner. I mean, it's a unilaterally imposed presidential death penalty on American citizens without a shred of due process. This is the power that the Obama administration, though not the Bush administration, has asserted for itself, has essentially seized. And one of the confirmed individuals on the list, the only one who's confirmed, is Anwar Awlaki, who is an American-born cleric, as you said, and is now currently in Yemen. And the U.S. has actually tried to kill Awlaki in late 2009 as part of those strikes in Yemen that we just discussed, where not only did the U.S. government lie and say that these airstrikes were not done by them. These airstrikes were actually targeting a U.S. citizen. That's what the U.S. government lied about and said that it wasn't them who was doing it, but the Yemeni government. So in order to prevent Obama from carrying out this assassination, this lawless assassination, the ACLU and Center for Constitutional Rights went into court on behalf of Awlaki's father and said that Awlaki's constitutional rights to due process are being violated. The Fifth Amendment says the government cannot deprive you of life or liberty or property without due process of law, which is exactly what this is. And the argument was that Awlaki himself cannot possibly emerge from hiding, and hire a lawyer and go into court because the United States government has made it very clear that the minute they know where he is, they want to kill him. And so he has to remain in hiding. So the only way that his constitutional rights can be vindicated is if a family member sues on his behalf. And this is a common doctrine. If someone is incapacitated, unconscious, or otherwise unable to assert their rights, you can have the next of kin or someone who can represent your interests sue on your behalf to vindicate your rights. And the government, in response, said that because Al-Waqi, there's nothing preventing him from doing it himself, his father has no standing to sue. And beyond that, they said decisions about who gets killed in war are purely for the president to make. The courts have no role whatsoever to play in reviewing those decisions. That's sort of a classic George Bush, Dick Cheney view of the world. And this federal judge, who was appointed by George W. Bush, a Bush 43 appointed judge, very right-wing and conservative, upheld the Obama DOJ's arguments and said that, indeed, that is true, that Al-Waqi could just do this himself, and so therefore his father can't sue, and that the courts have no role to play in decisions about who should get killed as part of wartime. And so the judge adopted those decisions. The judge did not rule on whether the president really has this power. And in fact, in his decision, he said it's an extraordinary and unprecedented power that Obama is asserting. It's extraordinary for the president to claim that he has the right to order American citizens killed with no due process. But unfortunately, said the court, I can't rule on this because the father lacks standing and it's not my role to override the president. So, you know, that's what the Bush administration constantly succeeded in doing, was protecting its own conduct from judicial review through these standing arguments, and the Obama administration is now following suit.
And what if they kill him? I mean, then who does anybody have standing in it? I mean, once he's dead.
Well, presumably if they kill him, and this is the irony of it, if they kill him, the father would become the executor of the estate and could then sue the government for damages for having killed his son unconstitutionally or illegally. So what the court is really saying is you need to wait until the president kills him, and then you can sue. Or he can stand up now and say, hey, I'm over here, I'm ready to sue, and then be killed. So it's really just a bizarrely Kafkaesque resolution that this court imposed, but that's the American judicial system.
Has the Obama administration, you know, given any reason why they have this guy on his list to be killed? Just because of his videos?
Well, that's the, you know, mystifying part about all of this, is that Al-Waqi has long been a cleric who, you know, basically Al-Waqi's message is to other Muslims, which says, as long as the United States continues to invade our countries and drop bombs on our lands and kill our women and children at checkpoints and through drone attacks, we have no choice but to attack the United States and to bring violence back to them. That's the only way we can defend ourselves, and that violence becomes justifiable because they're the aggressors. Therefore, you Muslims have not only the right but the sacred solemn duty to bring violence to the United States the way that they're bringing violence to us. Now, that message is obviously something that the United States considers threatening, but it's also unquestionably a political opinion that the First Amendment permits you to express without being punished. It's a legitimate political opinion that American citizens have the right to express without being punished for them. And so the Obama administration, knowing that it can't kill him because of these sermons, which is what their real concern is, has now invented the claim that he, at some point in the past 12 months, has become quote-unquote operational, that he's now not just sermonizing in favor of attacks but helping to plan the attacks. There's been no evidence presented to the public to support this claim. Most of it has been leaked anonymously, though a couple of Obama officials have put their name on it. But all it is an evidence-free accusation that's never been subjected to any public scrutiny, let alone due process in court. That's the basis on which so many people, Democrats and Republicans alike, are cheering for their fellow citizen to be murdered, namely just pure, untested assertions on the part of government officials that he's guilty.
All right. Well, Glenn Greenwald, thank you so much for your time. Obviously, you can check Glenn Greenwald out at Salon.com or pick up any one of his books, still just as relevant now as they were just a couple years ago when they were written, How Would a Patriot Act, A Tragic Legacy, and Great American Hypocrites. Glenn, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. Bye-bye.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hood, lay, hood, lay, hee-hoo. Now it was the voice
there you
of
go,
the
folks.
Lonely goat herd, lay, hood, lay,
it's the Christmas season.
Oh, holy
time for you to assassinate American citizen.
Oh, holy,
You know, I just think it's wrong that only the president gets to do that. I think that really the fair thing would be to give every American citizen an opportunity to assassinate one other American citizen. It would be a pretty fascinating experiment. Because it's quite possible a lot of people would choose the same person. You know, so it's sort of like a weird musical chairs type of thing, right? I mean, it would be really awkward if everybody chose a distinct person and then everybody would be dead. There'd be one person left at the end, right? Isn't that the way it would work?
Depends on if it's an odd or even census number.
Right. You'd actually probably have to make sure that you'd have to coordinate it. It would be too complicated. I guess we can't do that. Forget it. No, we shouldn't do that. Because it would be too complicated. Because if you'd really have to stagger it in a very awkward way. Because if I had chosen to assassinate Dorsey and Evan had chosen to assassinate me, and Evan assassinated me before I got a chance to shoot Dorsey or assassinate Dorsey, it would be no. Yeah. Okay. All right. Bad idea. Bad idea. We won't do that. Let's just have the president be able to assassinate people at will. And, yeah, that's better. Okay, I feel more comfortable with that. Oh, folks, come on! It's only Tuesday. It's only Tuesday. Oh, should we get into Afghanistan? Richard Holbrook died yesterday. He was our emissary. He was Petraeus' diplomatic wingman. And, you know, I don't know where Holbrook sits on the spectrum of these people. I imagine that to be a diplomat, an American diplomat, to work through the ranks, you've probably had to do some pretty bad things over the years. Yesterday we mentioned Kissinger. We'll deal with him a little bit later. But maybe we'll have somebody on to give us an assessment of Holbrook. But one thing that struck me, he was 69 years old when he died. One thing that struck me that I think has been widely reported, is that as he was sedated for surgery on Friday morning in George Washington, it's interesting, very strange in a way. I guess he had problems starting in August, and he underwent treatment for heart problems and canceled one of his trips to Afghanistan and Pakistan. On Friday morning, he was taken to George Washington University Hospital after he became flushed and suffered chest pains during a meeting with Secretary of State Clinton. And he had a torn aorta. And as he was sedated for surgery, his final words were to his Pakistani surgeon, which is coincidental in and of itself. According to family members, he said, quote, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan." One must imagine he knows what he's talking about. And it's quite clear that what we've got going on in Afghanistan is not working. Part of the reasons is I'm not clear exactly what it's supposed to do. I mean, does anybody really have a strong sense as to what our mission in Afghanistan is? I mean, our overall, what's the end game here? If it's to destroy the Taliban, guess what, folks?
I don't think so.
To the extent that we had an opportunity to destroy the Taliban, if we ever had an opportunity to destroy the Taliban that's most interested with Afghanistan anyways, that ship sailed probably 6-7 years ago. when the Bush administration decided to lead this country into an illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, premised on a lie, when they pulled $700 million of money earmarked from Afghanistan, sent it to Iraq. Now, I mean, honestly, I have no idea what our mission, obviously, is not to capture terrorists anymore, right? I mean, the to the extent that there's any international terrorists there, they seem to be living in Pakistan, up in the western region of Pakistan. And now we have a situation where apparently the Petraeus, we are now engaged in a series of bombings there that is three times the amount of aerial bombings that we performed at the same time in November. I mean, they're now basically just, I don't know if they're carpet bombing the place, but understand that the more aerial firepower you use, the more civilians die. That there is a one-to-one ratio there in terms of the truth of those assertions. The more aerial bombing you use, the more innocent civilians die, period. And that was always an issue that, you know, I thought that we had to go into Afghanistan. Back in the day, I had a problem with how we were doing it and that there weren't enough boots on the ground because, but we know why that was the case. It's much easier to just make bombs and drop them, particularly if you're planning to go into Iraq. David Dayan, and I, you know, we've got to get him back on, but I'm overwhelmed by the amount of work that David Dayan does. It's astonishing. At Fire Dog Lake News, I honestly am beginning to wonder if he's even human. He writes that two upcoming national intelligence estimates on Afghanistan and Pakistan will say that the fight is not winnable without Pakistani engagement against Taliban militants on its side of the border. And incredibly, he goes on to say, military commanders challenge the conclusion, saying they don't take this into account, the alleged progress made this fall. Washington Post reports that sitting at the head of a glass-topped U-shaped table in his conference room, Ahmed Karzai refused to budge, according to two people with direct knowledge of the late October meeting. He insisted that Afghan police and soldiers could protect reconstruction workers, and he dismissed pleas for a delay. This is in terms of Karzai putting forward some projects he was going to put into gear. As he spoke, he grew agitated, then enraged. He told them that he now has three main enemies: the Taliban, the United States, and the international community. Quote, "If I had to choose sides today, I'd choose the Taliban," he fumed. Whatever notion that we thought that we were going to accomplish in Afghanistan, it's quite clear that we're not going to now. And that all that we really are capable of doing is killing some Taliban, probably killing more civilians, hopefully not at the same rate in which we killed civilians relative to insurgents in Iraq, but undoubtedly close. And destabilizing the region more. It's clear we are not stabilizing things in Pakistan in any way. The Guardian UK reports that a Pakistani journalist whose relatives were killed in a U.S. drone strike has started a legal push to charge America's top spy in Pakistan with murder. Khan says his brother and son, both government employees, were killed in a CIA drone strike on their home near Mir Ali in North Waziristan in December of 2009. Khan's allegations are difficult to confirm. Independently, information about civilian deaths from U.S. Drone strikes is widely disputed, of course. largely because the lawless tribal belt is out of reach to foreign and even most Pakistani journalists. Right, so there you have it, folks. Things going great in Afghanistan, and despite the fact that our chief diplomatic diplomat there probably would have been Secretary of State if Obama wasn't afraid of Hillary Clinton politically. His dying words are, we've got to get out of this war in Afghanistan. We've got to end this war in Afghanistan. Now, when he says, end this war in Afghanistan, do you think he's like, we've got to convince the Taliban to lay down their arms? Do you think that's what he's saying? Or do you think that he's saying, I think it's time for us to bring our troops home and stop killing civilians? But that would be weak! We would be criticized. We would be criticized by the right wing. Because while deficit is the most dangerous thing to us, there's nothing more dangerous than stopping killing civilians. Those are the two most dangerous things. The deficit and not killing civilians. And Julian Assange. Those are the three most dangerous things. The deficit, not killing civilians, and Julian Assange, and the notion that everybody would have health care. Those are the four most dangerous things that we must defend ourselves against at all costs. And fortunately, the Obama administration is cooperating with us on three out of four. So there you have it. And speaking of the other most dangerous things, of course, I'm speaking about the notion that gay people would serve in the military. Now, that's the other thing that could be, oh, God, cats and dogs sleeping together. 80% of the American public favors getting rid of this ridiculously retarded policy. But, you know, and despite the fact that Obama pledged to get rid of it, despite the fact that the courts seem to be getting rid of it, which, you know, even the Republican Secretary, Robert Gates, says he would rather it be legislative so they actually have a chance to plan for it as opposed to it just be immediate. I mean, I imagine they feel that about any policy. But as that guy who I was on Dylan Radigan with at one point, not this time, but the last time, was talking about all the problems that you could have that we aren't having resolved yet if you get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Like, what if chaplains want to marry two gay soldiers? Yeah, that's a huge issue. Who knows how you could... My God! So yesterday, White House Press Secretary, according to the Wonk Room at CAP, Robert Gibbs refused to say that President Obama would call on the Senate to stay in session until it brought the standalone measure to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now, Obama's done this for the START Treaty. Do you remember what I said, folks? Did I say this? I guess I said this on Olbermann. I guess I said this to that log cabin Republican on Olbermann when I was subbing for Olbermann. Does it strike you as strange that it's not just a question of extending the time in which the Senate is in session? You know, that's what Harry Reid has claimed he'll do. He'll extend the time from the 17th to the 23rd, up until the moment or whatever it is, the 31st, it doesn't matter. He'll extend the Senate being open. And that's what this log cabin Republican guy was interested in. And I said, well, but isn't sort of the problem not so much the length of time that the Senate is in session, but the timing of the agenda? Because it's clear everyone's going to stay for the START Treaty. Because it has bipartisan support. And it's a vote that everyone wants to take, whether they're for it or against it. But the vote that people don't want to take is the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So what would you do, Evan Dorsey, if you wanted everybody to be around for the Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
put the Star Treaty after it.
Oh, my God. You guys win a cookie. Doris, you didn't get a chance to answer, but you get a cookie, too.
I'll take one.
And by... and I'm, of course, I'm not talking literally. That would cost money. I'm talking you get a metaphorical cookie.
We need gold stars instead of cookies.
That's, well... well, you get a metaphorical gold star. Look, we're on a tight budget. So Obama will not say this. And, in fact, I don't know if Harry Reid will schedule it that way. Probably not. Carl Levin called on Obama to use his bully pulpit to urge the Senate to stay in right up to New Year's. Now, of course, you know, what can happen is the Senate can be open, but nobody just shows up. All you need is one guy for a filibuster. You don't have sixty votes to move on the procedural motion to close debate. Blah blah blah. There it is. You know what? I'm going to have to talk about the tax deal tomorrow. I don't think much is going to change between now and then. The Senate looks like they're going to pass it. They got through a procedural hurdle, but there are conservatives again who are now squawking about the deal. Somehow Mooney Analytics, go to a Fire Dog Lake. Jane Hampshire's posted this. It's really hilarious. Moody's analytics or analysis, they last week the guy said this deal is great for the economy, and this week he says it's bad for the deficit. We shouldn't do it. Within a week, the same guy. And, of course, the reporters didn't seem to pick up on that. So the deal could run into problems in the House. I mean, you know, I watched Lawrence O'Donnell last night against my better judgment, could not sleep. I did see one of the most fascinating five-windowed panels.
Oh, wow.
Did you ever see that?
I didn't make it that far. I went to, yeah.
Okay, let's see if I can remember it. That economic policy guy that he thinks is the best in the country, Washington establishment guy, may be good, may very well be good. Older gentleman. Balding, white. Ed Rendell, the older gentleman, governor of Pennsylvania, white. John Fund, the middle-aged, extremely white guy from the Wall Street Journal. Was he still there? Howard Fineman, older, white gentleman. Now at the Huffington Post, I believe.
Senior editor.
Oh, excuse me. Wow. And Lawrence O'Donnell. Really, honestly, I almost took a picture of my TV again. because it was just like, wow. It's just like a wave. I mean, that was just pretty impressive. And Lawrence did the whole show on the tax deal. Like, it was like he was playing Steny Hoyer bingo. Steny Hoyer showed up, clips of Steny Hoyer showed up on almost every segment, you know, talking about the tax deal. And then he spent the rest of the time quoting Charles Krautheimer or somebody else from, I mean, it was a pretty stunning.
What about the beginning when he was kind of just like laughing at Claire McCaskill while she was talking? It seemed like.
He was ecstatic. He really felt that, you know, he was going to win, and then he referenced.
The best part, though? When he was talking to Gibbs.
And right.
What did he do?
Yes.
He had to talk about the West Wing.
Yes. I hear you reference my TV show. I mean, I guess I would do the same thing, but it was just, it was really a inside the Beltway love fest. And, you know, again, I hope this tax deal does not go through. I really do. I think it's a very dangerous, any benefits that will accrue in the short term to, people who make less than 40,000, families that make less than $40,000 a year, individuals that make less than $20,000 a year, I believe will be diminished three times fold when it comes time for their retirement, frankly, or if they need disability. I think it's a danger for Social Security. I think it's a danger for all sorts of government services. So I'm against it. I think the stimulative effects. Will not be significant enough to make a change. I think you need to, you know, President Obama said the Republicans are going to be responsible. Well, let's hold them to the fire. I mean, let's make them account. But we shall see. All right, folks, we got plenty more for tomorrow. And thanks for joining us. If you stick around in the post-show. Oh, this is going to be an exciting week. I have some important announcements to make this week. And we'll be making them as the week goes on. Again, please, if you can, and I want to thank, we had a new dirty effing hippie join us yesterday. And a couple of Cedaristas and a couple of majority reporters. If you can, please join your membership. Funds this show 100%. Well, let me rephrase that. 100% of your membership goes to funding the show. It's not quite at the point where the show is funded 100% by your membership. We're running a deficit. Let's put it that way. And we need your funding, your support to continue this program. And again, if you sent me an email, if you asked for a mug, and I sent you confirming that we have it, please, if you would rather have a DVD, we're going to upgrade you, because it turns out we don't have enough mugs. So you can choose any DVD, go to the members site, check out the mugs there. And also, justcoffee.coop. We're just about to have a cup right now from Neferkitty's coffee maker that she sent us. Justcoffee.coop. Put majority in your coupon code to get 10% off. We'll talk to you tomorrow, or stick around for the IM session at Majority FM. We're back. Oh, I forgot to mention this, but Larry Summers, what a douche. What a douche.
You are a douchebag.
Larry Summers, in his final speech out the door, urged that spending on highways and other infrastructure be increased in his final major address that, as Obama's top economic advisor. Every report that I have seen said that Christine Romer, when she sat on his board of economic advisors, Obama's, suggested we needed $1.5 trillion or $1.2 trillion worth of stimulus. Larry Summers quashed that. So here you have this.
You are a douchebag.
On his way out the door, back to his cush life, and returning from his cush life, which he left his cush life to be cush, is, you know, this is a huge CYA. I was calling for more stimulus. Look at my speech when I left the White House. Unbelievable. God, I'm so sickened by these people. So sickened. What are you going to do, folks? What are you going to do? You can IM me at Majority FM or Cedar MBS. Neferkitty, good morning, Sam. Evan and Dorsey are here. I was shofared yesterday. Sorry I missed it, but thank you for the honor. It's my gift in return, as the goddess Neferkitty has brought snow just enough to make it feel like Christmas. Enjoy. Thank you. We had a nice little dusting here in New York City. End game in Afghanistan, mining rights for their mineral wealth. Yes, but we won't get. Yeah, I guess that's true. Doesn't look good, though. Great interview with Glenn yesterday, majority follower. Keep up the great work. Don't you think that the failure of Congress meeting their constitutional requirement of doing oversight of spending leaves members in the executive branch no choice but to leak classified information to expose their corruption? If Senator Lieberman has such a big issue with WikiLeaks, couldn't he hold the hearings in the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee to address the corruption before it gets leaks? Of course, that hearing, that wouldn't be as hard-hitting as important national security as Clinton's Christmas card list. Yes. Sevre. Crane, UPS guy is union, Sam. Teamsters, healthcare reform is good for employers and unions. Both. Fair enough, cranes flying. I was in favor of health care reform. I remain in favor of health care reform. I wanted the public option. I would be in favor of health care reform without the mandate, frankly. I talked to a guy last night who sat down with a bunch of healthcare insurance presidents, and he said that they don't know if this thing is going to get repealed. They don't know anything. They did say that the cost to coverage ratio, what was it? You know what I'm talking about? There's a medical loss to coverage ratio. There's some ratio between essentially the money that they pay out for medical expenses and their revenue. Their profits are capped. And the way apparently they're going to try and get around this is by offering different elements of health insurance a la carte. So your actual like health care coverage, guess that would be, I don't know exactly what it would be, but somewhat close to catastrophic care or something like that would be within those parameters, but everything else would be outside those parameters, like, I don't know, eyeglass coverage or certain visits to the doctors or wellness, you add it a la carte. I'm not exactly sure. And then another guy joined us for drinks who told me that Social Security, there's no money in the trust fund. It's just IOUs. And I was like, God damn it. I'm not a bright guy. A nice guy. And I said, dude, do you think your money is in the bank? Like, do you think your money, like when you went in there with your check or your cash, do you think that's sitting in the bank? Or do you think you're just a name on a ledger that says they owe you this? I mean, what do you think a bank run is? When everybody goes to take their money out, guess what they find? Their money's not in the bank. It's loaned out to somebody. Basically, what's sitting in there is an IOU. The only difference is that the money, the IOU sitting in the... And he said, well, the FDIC, the federal government, backs up that money. Yeah! Yeah! Guess what the IOUs are in the Social Security Trust Fund in that file cabinet? Look at this. Do you remember that video of George Bush with the file cabinet? Look at this. The file cabinet. This is where papers in here with IOUs saying that there's no money here. It's just IOUs. File cabinet. What do you think? They put your IOUs in the bank in a vault? Seriously. God, this guy was a bright guy. And I was like, you know, well, the FDIC. Well, what do you think? Who do you think backs up the IOUs that are in the trust fund? The same entity, the U.S. government. With the full faith and credit. In fact, you probably get more, our Social Security trust fund IOUs probably get more interest than your savings rate. Or your checking, at least. Probably your savings rate, even, in your bank. Money's not there either. God, so annoying. And then all of a sudden, he just goes, freedom! It's about freedom and liberty! Sam McKim is frozen on me, says Rusty Cole, about an hour ago. Melanie Sloan had quite a surprise back in February. Says Harold, somebody tried to FedEx 33 pounds of marijuana to her doorsteps. As a lawyer, of course, she called the police. Personally, I would have paid off the mortgage. At least $150,000 street value. JDF, I was bored Sunday and watched the dreadful Leon Charney report. Paul Bremer was on and still making the case for invading Iraq. By the way, I had no idea that Charney was a billionaire. Who's Leon Charney?
Is that like the conservative?
You're thinking of Stuart Varney.
No. There's like a conservative news network that's like, they're kind of like a live streamy thing.
Maybe.
I'm not sure. I think I probably watched it.
On Marin's podcast, Janine said, be that as it may, at least twice. Did you get that from her or other way around? Kevin semicolon. You know, that's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. I have no doubt that one of us got it from each other. But now we're using it willy-nilly. Been listening to Marin's podcast with Louis C.K. He started with the story of him sitting next to... did you hear this about when he sat next to Ken Melman on the plane and was tweeting it live?
I think so.
And he took like a picture of him with his nipple while Melman was sleeping. It's pretty funny. Of course, he leaves out the part that he was IMing me. During that point, I was, you know, giving him questions to ask to fuck with, because I don't think that part actually panned out that well. How about a method incentive for booster donation, one-time helpouts, independence of the monthly setup? Oh, yeah, you know, we will do something like that. I think I know what you're saying. I think we will do something like that. Larry Summers was in The Social Network. He was in the movie? Oh, yeah, that would make sense because Zuckerberg went to Harvard, right? I mean, that's where Facebook got started.
But the real Summers was in there?
Well, I don't know. Did you hear Glenn Greenwald's interview with Nir Rosen? Awesome. No, I haven't. I've got to listen to that. Johnny, speaking of Lanny Davis, remember when he was on the Ed Schultz show and Ed made the surprise reveal that Lanny would be debating Jane Hampshire? No, I don't.
That was the top search when I did.
Oh, yeah?
Accuses progressives. It said, watch Lanny Davis yell at Jane Hampshire on the Ed show.
Well, who was a surprise for her, Jane or for Lanny? I would imagine
probably
Lanny.
For Lanny, yeah.
Upbeat Nihilist, I never tire of hearing you riff on Lionel. Can you devote some time to exploring just how big of a douche he is in the future? Also enjoy the inside dirt on AAR days. Keep it coming. What? Oh, I never... What was that student government spring fling story?
Something about... I think you were drunk.
You were buzzed.
I was buzzed, and I went in to speak to the Board of Trustees about divestment from South Africa. Well, I'll tell that someday. When we have Chris Rosen in, we'll tell the Mark Green story.
I'll make an effort to keep an eye out for Lionel on Ed. And maybe
He also does something on like New York One too, doesn't he? Come on, it's like, hi, I'm doing an annoying minute. Or New York Picks.
It's better on Ed because it's like he only gets a certain amount of time, and Ed just like lets him go. And then when the time's done, he's still trying to like get something out before the camera like cuts away from him completely. It's amazing.
Hmm. Don't be a putt. Steinbrenner just one of five billionaires who died this year, and whose heirs paid zero estate tax. The current tax deal, the Wall Street Journal reports, actually makes 2010 even sweeter for wealthy heirs. These heirs face a capital gains tax on the profits they make from selling the stock they inherited in 2010. The new tax deal gives heirs the choice of paying the capital gains tax or having the 2010 estate tax of their dear devoted taxed at that much. Reduced tax rate for whichever costs less. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not even... Look, I have a problem with the estate tax is ridiculous. But I have it's not so much that I have a problem with the taxes on the rich being extended or the estate tax. My biggest concerns, because that's somewhat stimulative, the estate tax isn't at all, I don't think. The tax cuts on the rich is, and by somewhat, I mean like virtually not. But I'm not too concerned about the deficit right now. What is a concern to me is that inevitably, when it comes time, the Republicans are going to use this as a justification to cut programs. Not for the wealthy. It's the redistribution of wealth that I have a problem with here. And if I trusted Obama and the Democrats to protect Social Security... to raise the rates on the rich, the tax rates on the rich first, then I wouldn't have a problem with this. But I don't. I don't trust them. Even if I did trust their intentions, their political acumen has been proven to be wrong multiple times. So, the bottom line, I think it's just too much of a risk. Sugar High, how come the Senate was able to pass the tax cuts first? Don't budget-related bills have to pass the House first? The whole reason the Bush cuts weren't permanent in the first place was because they were passed through reconciliation. Well, they weren't permanent because they wanted to hide the cost of these things. And so the way that people account for them is they do these 10-year windows and they just make it sound, and they do the projections over the course of 20 years. So they cut it for 10 years, and they said, but over the next 20 years, it will only cost X amount of dollars. Well, I think it's got to go. The Senate can pass it, and then I think it can go to the House as is. But if the House changes it, it's got to go back to the Senate. And I think they wanted to make a test vote, at least on the cloture, because they wanted to send a message that the Senate's willing to pass, get basically a sense of what the Senate is doing. That's my sense. The most significant thing we can do is nullify News Corp. How? Says Kevin 11721. I disagree. I think the most significant thing we can do is have publicly financed campaigns. We should have Lawrence Lessig on, see if he can talk about that. I've had conversations with him in the past. Maybe we can run one during a break and then have him back on. Excessives Wear, I want to upgrade my membership to Cedarista. Should I cancel and start a new membership at that level? Yes! Of course! Thank you, Excessives Wear. Long Doggies, 67. Question, did something happen to Lawrence O'Donnell? It was always a dick and I just didn't notice it before. I've talked about this before. You know, when Lawrence used to come on to the Majority Report and the Sam Cedar Show back in the day, we would have good arguments about this, and he was sort of an establishment beltway type of liberal. And my sense is that he tacked a little bit to the left, although maybe not so much the left, but publicly just became more of an outsider in like 2008 and was that way for a couple of years, and now he's back to, you know, where he was.
Well, I mean, you pointed out also that he was doing a lot of Keith's show, and, you know, he's doing Keith's show, so.
Exactly, you know. Exactly. Gulfstream, Malloy has a good fundraising thing going. You can sponsor an hour, and he reads your message 3 to 4 times an hour. Interesting. I think we did that on the Majority Report as a Netroots Nation thing, and it was all 9/11. I think I gave the guy like a 2-minute recording that he could run. I think it was a 9/11 truth thing, but it wasn't, you know, it was pretty reasonable. I don't know. That's something that we can do. Shank, if the tax deal goes through, does that mean that Joe the Plumber wins? What is Joe the Plumber doing these days?
He surfaced somewhere like a couple weeks ago, I think. I forget what it was. But, yeah, he'll still be around.
Great. Great. Spayf, Randy's really trying to convince us that the cuts in taxes are in our best interest. She asked one guy if he would want his salary to go down 3%. When he said he was willing to pay more taxes, I was screaming in my head, every time my taxes go down, I make even less salary. Or I lose days of work. Okay, I think what Spayf is saying here is that employers know when your payroll tax goes down. Well, first of all, it's a 2% drop in the payroll tax. But be that as it may, employers usually factor this in. I mean, I think I went through this exercise, right? Where if I knew that Let's say, hypothetically speaking, that I was paying Dorsey and Evan. And hypothetically, they're paying taxes on this. And if I knew that their taxes went down 2%, I knew that they would be 2% happier even without me doing anything. So I don't have to. So when they complain, like, hey, I need a 10% raise so that I can afford to buy a soda across the street. I said, well, look, I know you just got a 2% raise, essentially. Don't complain to me about drink water. It's healthier from the tap in the men's room. That's how that conversation would go. I mean, look, I don't think it's unreasonable to say that certain groups need these tax breaks. Certain people need these tax breaks, and so it's very, very important. I just think that there's something very obvious going on here. I mean, George Bush, you know, I mean, would the Republicans say, like, we're not going to allow, I mean, when would Republicans ever say, like, we're not going to allow that tax cut? They argue against a tax cut. Now, I guess they did get away with voting against $250,000, but if Barack Obama, instead of giving a 2% payroll tax, just simply used the payroll tax as a way of calculating that 2%, whatever you paid, I'm going to give you a rebate out of the general fund. I'm going to send you a check from Barack Obama, just like George Bush did. Right? We talked about this with Rorty Baum. It would be better politically. Psychologically, I think there is evidence to show that people spend that when it comes in more, as opposed to just having more in their paycheck because they see it as a bonus. And then you don't tie Social Security into draining the general fund. You know, it's one thing to borrow money from Social Security Trust Fund and leave some IOUs in there. It's another thing to simply just say, like, oh, we'll make up the revenue in Social Security by actively paying out from the general fund, even though Social Security is not, even though we're not borrowing money from there. And that's a problem, folks. That's a serious, serious problem. I'm happy now. Forgive it. It's been mentioned. Can you raise the levels on your cohorts? Hard to hear.
Done.
Guys, I say this every day.
I think it's that we move a lot relative to the mic.
I'll talk like this from now on.
Well, look at that's how I do it. Just don't right? put your lips on that microphone.
Does that sound right?
We need to put a, you know, we put a wind thing on that mic. We have one, don't we?
I don't know. I'll find one.
Crystal Count, speaking of Joe the Plumber, randomly I came on the original Obama v. Joe discussion on tax cuts. Ironically, Obama brilliantly argues the progressive case against the tax cut package he's selling now. For an irony excursion, sometimes it's 5 minutes. I remember that. He says we've got to spread the wealth around. Yeah, of course. But their argument is like, you know, anybody who votes for this is going to be like, look, there's a lot of things I don't like. We have to compromise. There's nothing we can do. Blah, 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 blah. Upbeat Nihilist, I understand Randy's logic that passing current tax package will put us in better posture when tax cuts expire in a year or two, worth some of the goodies we get out of it. She seems to ignore the Social Security General Fund trap, but her overall argument makes some sense. Letting cuts expire, then getting renewed by GOP-controlled Congress puts us behind the eight ball. Basically, we'd like our shit sandwich with or without the mayo. Well, no, because look, first of all, the stimulative effects of this tax cut have already been determined to run out at the end of 2011. A. B. The stimulative effects of these tax cuts, because we have no negotiating power, the beginning of next year will be even further diminished by the fact that Republicans will start to cut programs. Now, what did Democrats have to offer them at that point? Well, we'd offer you millionaire tax cuts. Oh, we already gave that away. It's the only shit Democrats have. In fact, I would argue the estate tax is also the only shit that Democrats have. Let that puppy go up to 55% for estates above 700 grand. Spin this battle right now, saying we want X, Y, and Z. Add to the package. Add to the package. Make Republicans reject it again. You don't think Republicans are going to come back and demand an estate tax repeal or a change in it? You don't think Republicans are going to demand more tax cuts? Okay, we're willing to negotiate now. We're willing to negotiate. We'll give you millionaires tax cuts, but we want... remember before you wouldn't vote for this package with a third? Well, now it's 20 months of unemployment. Remember how you scuttled the estate tax? Well, now it's Build America Bonds program. The people who are for this tax cut are operating in a vacuum. It's as if this is what the terrain is going to be next. We're going to be in a worse bargaining position after January. Do you understand that? And we're going to be in a much worse position if we have nothing to offer the Republican Party by way of tax cuts. That's it. Don't be a putz. I know those Goldman Sachs guys are wicked smart and all, but if I loaned you $1 million and you had to pay me back $1,078,000 one year, do you think you can make a profit on that? Of course. Of course.
Catch Colbert last night?
No.
One of his staff found a Goldman Sachs partner's credit card, his Goldman Sachs card, on the street in Tribeca. And Colbert started off the segment doing something about Elizabeth Warren being outraged about bankers' bonuses. And he's like, I want the other side of the story. I want one of the Goldman Sachs bankers to come in, but I haven't had any luck. He's like, luckily I found this card. And so I Googled the guy's name. It's a real person and a real Goldman Sachs partner, and he's going to reveal one number from the credit card every night until the guy comes on his show.
Fantastic.
It is great.
Fantastic. Kevin, 11721, tired of millionaires telling me the tax package isn't so bad. There you go. Whether or not Randy Rhodes is right on policy is less important than she has been calling her listeners stupid at whiners over and over again. Last time she got like this, she disappeared from the air, not saying anything, just saying. You know, a lot of people are IMing me that. I get to listen to Randy. Spayef, when callers bring up your great points, Randy starts singing Lonely Goat Herd. She says she is a positive person and can't be that negative. What is Lonely Goat Herd? Is that a song?
I have no idea.
Is that a song? Spayef? Farmer Gillian. Always learn something from your show, and this time it was about Cruz Melanie Sloan. Been getting Cruz emails and can't remember an email announcement on her selling her soul. American Prospects blog said the spin around the move is that Davis's firm is gearing up to defend Democrats from investigations expected to be launched by House Republicans. And the blog reported a tweet from Glenn Greenwald that leaving Crew to work for Lanny Davis would be like leaving the ACLU to work for Dick Cheney. Thanks for all your hard work. I mean, I imagine Lanny Davis is gearing up for that shit. Of course. He gets paid four ways to Sunday. Your Sound of Music clip. I don't know the name. She starts singing? That's weird. Oh, wait. What? So you're saying that people actually reference me on Randy's show and she responds by singing...
High on a hill was a lonely goat, her lay, or lay, or lay.
Is that true? She starts singing or plays the clip? Because I got news for you. That's my clip. That is my clip that I have personally stolen and used without copyright protection. Kevin semicolon. I've never felt happier since I stopped listening, Randy. That's the title of the high. Yes, I understand. That's what Julie Andrews is actually saying. Yes, it's a little hard to understand. No, I get it. I get it. Play it. No, not that I've heard. I think it's a metaphor. Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. I'm being metaphorical. Ah, okay. Fair enough. High on the hill with a lonely goat herd. I see. I promise never to do that again. If someone buys a Cedarista membership right now, I can't wait till we get to that point where I hold you people hostage. All right, folks. Hey, if you're ever on anybody's message boards, by all means, tell people that we're here live. Particularly, you know, we're over the course of two different time slots, so we never compete with anybody directly. And, you know, look, we're a knit. We're a tiny little knit on the back of those big progressive radio shows. But get the word out. I will have some really great news. News I'm very excited about. And I think you guys would be excited about it, too. I don't know why you wouldn't. Because it will help this show. And by an incredibly indirect route, help Dorsey and Evan. Very, very indirect. Extremely indirect. Like just like a distant breeze. But I will make that announcement in the next day or two or three. All right, folks. See you tomorrow. Take care of yourself. The man.